you said the day of your announcing when you came to Iowa that you're comfortable as the underdog in this race for the Democratic presidential nomination. You've had a very strong staff presence in Iowa. You've spent a lot of time here. What are you hearing from Iowans? What do they want in a president?
Well, what I hear all across Iowa and really all across our country is that people are very, very anxious about whether or not we're going to be able to give our kids a better quality of life, healthier, more prosperous, safer quality of life than our parents and grandparents gave to us. And we know that with an economy that where we all seem to be working harder but falling further behind, that we need new leadership and we need an ability to get things done again. And Clay, those are really the two phrases I hear everywhere are the phrases new leadership and getting things done. There's a sense that that big money has so taken over our politics that we've lost the ability to find common ground and to get things done for the benefit of our kids. So that's why I run. It's, call it the American dream, call it an economy that works for all of us again. It's possible. It was not so long ago when wherever you started in our country, you could get ahead. And we need to restore the truth of that dream.
How do you feel you're getting your name out there? Do you feel like you're connecting more the more time you spend here?
I do. I have seen this process unfold with other candidates who were not very well known but managed to go town to town to town. And I know just how seriously the people of Iowa take their responsibility. So I've been pleasantly surprised at how many people are coming out to hear what I have to say and to what I have to offer. And that's how you do it in Iowa. You go town to town, living room to living room. So I'm very encouraged. I feel like every time we come back, and I've been now to 19 of the 99 counties in just 40 days. Every time we come back, we make some more friends and stitch together a better organization across the state. So I need to get my name recognition up over the course of this summer and then continue to move into the debate season and grow this campaign and its support.
One issue that's caused some divisiveness within your own party has been on trade. We had the TPP, the president supported it, Republicans in the Senate and the House supported it. You oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
I am very opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I'm fundamentally, as an American, opposed to secret trade deals that our Congress has to vote on before the rest of us are even allowed to read it. I believe that good trade deals for the United States raise protections for workers and wages and raise protections for the environment. Bad trade deals lower protections for workers and lower protections for the environment. After what we saw with NAFTA, I think that all of us should pause to consider whether it really is in the best interest of our economy. I don't doubt that this would help juice corporate profits, especially for big corporations that can offshore jobs and offshore their profits. That I have no doubt. But I do doubt, and I have very grave concerns about whether or not this really builds a stronger economy here at home.
One argument you hear a lot in the state of Iowa in favor of trade deals like the TPP is that one in five jobs in Iowa is somehow related to agriculture. They might not be working the farm, but it has some kind of tie to agriculture. This trade deal is seen as a good thing to get those goods out to other countries. What do you say to that argument?
Well, I believe that we are already engaged in trade around the world, and I think it is that we need to be engaged in trade. I have, as governor, led trade delegations selling products from my state, including agricultural products, all over the world. But that's different than this deal, which creates these weird tribunals that allow corporations to sue their own government, namely the United States, in order to avoid abiding by protections for workers, protections for the environment, and that concerns me greatly. But I do understand that we're part of a global economy. Look, I'm from Maryland. Right in the center of our state is the Port of Baltimore. I made big investments in our port so that we could compete. But I believe that this trade deal, this secret trade deal, is not good for our economy. We need to focus on building up our own economy, not going in a race to the bottom and sending more jobs abroad.
So would there have been a better trade deal to negotiate, or none at all, and just focus domestically?
You know, I have supported trade deals in the past. I supported the South Korean trade deal, and I believe that there was There were others supporting it as well, including a couple of labor unions, because it had protections for workers, because it had protections for the environment. And those are the deals that we should be chasing. I don't buy the notion that somehow our entire national security depends on our being able to ship American manufacturing jobs to Asia more quickly than global forces are already taking them.
Transitioning a little bit here to the economy, not too much of a change, but there's been a movement to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. You support that?
I do support it. I think we should be supportive of raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour wherever we can. For most of 30 years, we followed a trickle-down theory of economics that had three components. One was concentrate wealth at the top. The second one was remove regulation everywhere you can, including even Wall Street. And the third part was keep wages low so we can be more competitive. But what we've found is that we've now gone through the first decade, this side of World War II, where wages for the majority of us, for 70% of us, have either flatlined or declined. And you cannot have a consumer economy that is actually growing at a decent clip if 70% of us are making the same or less than we were 10 years ago. Our parents and grandparents, Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, always found ways to keep wage policies at the forefront of our economic choices. In other words, to provide a floor so that wages would go up with productivity and not down. And we need to restore that. If the minimum wage had kept pace with inflation, it would be approaching $15 an hour anyway. And I think what you're going to see is that cities like Seattle and other places that raise the minimum wage will see that that's good for their economy and not bad.
Year after year in the legislature here in Iowa, Senate Democrats, they control the Senate, they introduce bills to try to raise the minimum wage, or they talk about it here in the state. Our Republican governor here in Iowa once upon a time approved a minimum wage hike. Why is it a federal issue? Why not have states control where to set the minimum wage?
Yeah, it's very interesting. My state of Maryland has been called America in miniature. So we have very rural parts of our state, and then we have very, very urban, and we have metropolitan suburban communities as well. So I think what you're seeing happening in our country right now is that increasingly the federal government will become the floor, and some states will actually raise their minimum wage above the federal floor, and you will see metropolitan areas, cities and counties, raising it even higher than their state. So there are many of us who claim to have progressive values in this race in the Democratic Party for president, but I have not only progressive values, but I've actually enacted them into law and put them into action. In our state, we raised the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, and I encouraged two of our counties to go higher, which they did. They went to $12.80.
How long ago was that?
My last year in office. And the more workers earn, the more and better customers businesses have, and the more our economy grows. Nobody should play by the rules and have to raise their children in poverty.
I've also heard you talk—
That's what I believe.
I've also heard you talk about raising the minimum wage as being something to help strengthen Social Security in the idea that they'd be paying more taxes.
Right.
And then contributing more to Social Security. One of the arguments you hear regularly is that raising minimum wage is going to create a burden on business. They're going to have to lay off staff because they can't afford to keep these workers. What do you make of that argument?
Yeah, I've not seen that play out. It certainly was not our experience in my home state where we did this. That has not been the experience in Seattle, and that has not been the experience in other states that have raised the minimum wage. I mean, I suppose you can get to a point where, you go way too far. But I don't believe that raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour is too far. And in another policy, and this went kind of under the radar screen, but back in the 70s, two-thirds of households made some overtime pay in the course of a year. But we never raised the threshold for overtime pay. So now hardly anyone in our economy ever makes overtime pay, time and a half, unless you're already working at poverty wages. And so these are the sort of policies, the wage policies, that allowed everybody to get ahead wherever they started in our economy. We need to restore them.
Do you think President Obama has done a good job in his terms in office of taking care of the economy and keeping job growth going?
Well, we are certainly doing better than we were when he took over. We have now had 64 months in a row, I do believe, maybe it's 65 now, of positive month-over-month job growth. That's a lot better than it was when he walked in, and many of us, I was governor then, watching people losing their jobs and their homes and fighting and doing everything we can to turn things around. So clearly our country's doing better. Clearly our economy in one sense is doing better, that we're creating jobs. But we can't say our economy's really working well for us when I saw in Iowa that 65% of the income gains since the recession went to the top 1% or 2% of Iowans. And the same is true in our country. The inverse of that is that until we can get wages to go up, until the majority of us are doing better and not worse, we can't say that our economy is really recovered. So no wonder people get angry when they hear politicians saying, wow, our economy's recovered, and yet they're bringing home less in real pay terms than we were 10 years ago.
It's a good segue into something else I wanted to bring up, and that's Wall Street reform. Your campaign, you've been putting Wall Street in the crosshairs. You've called on other Democrats in this race to put forward specific policies to overhaul Wall Street. What do you propose?
This is what I am proposing. There's, in essence, a few parts to it. One is that for 70 years, we separated speculative banking from the sort of commercial and deposit banking, and we insured the deposit and the commercial banking because of the lessons that we learned back in the Great Depression. So in order to prevent runs on banks, in order to keep credit in our economy, we insured those deposit and commercial banks. Well, in the 90s, we allowed the speculative banks, the banks that gamble big time and take big risks in order to get big returns, we started insuring them. And as a result, we have now gotten to a point where just four or five big mega banks on Wall Street now control over 50% of the banking assets of the country. And so we got into a situation in the last crash, in the Bush recession, that banks were too big to jail, too big to fail, too big to manage. And when they collapsed, all of us had to bail them out because otherwise our entire economy would go into a Great Depression. So number one, I propose that we reinstate and pass a modern version of Glass-Steagall so that we separate the commercial banks from the speculative and you and I as taxpayers are no longer on the hook. If that's real capitalism, then if they take a risk and they fail, that's on them and we don't have to bail them out. The second piece of it is I believe that we need to end the revolving door among those who we count on to regulate Wall Street and protect us from this huge concentration of financial power in our financial sector. So we need to end the revolving door, the coziness that exists when people come from an industry, regulate that industry for a few years, go back to the industry, often to the same people that they were regulating before. The third piece of this is we need to put more cops on the Wall Street beat. I have proposed that we double the funding for the Securities and Exchange Commission and for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. The Republican Congress has resisted attempts to increase staffing there, and it's almost, and with the influence of the big mega banks who don't want more oversight, it's like having Al Capone setting the budget for the Chicago Police Department.
So how do you get Republicans to get on board with a plan like that? How do you work bipartisan? Do you have examples of serving as governor when that happened?
Sure. I mean, there were many things that we accomplished during my time as governor that we would not have accomplished were it not for some Republican votes. Marriage equality was one of them. Repealing the death penalty was one of them. And so as an executive, one of the things that you have to learn is that every vote, there's a different combination of votes. And some of the biggest resistance I got within my own party for things like raising the minimum wage came from within my party, not from the Republican Party. So as an executive, you have to call the legislators all the time. You have to meet with them. You have to understand their perspective and where they're coming from. It would be nice if we lived in a post-partisan world, but that's not the way the world works. But we do, fortunately, still live in a world where we can talk to each other decently as individuals, even if we may disagree 9 out of 10 times. There's always that 10th time. But more to the call of your question, every election is an opportunity for a deeper understanding among us, the electorate. So I intend to build a consensus for reigning in Wall Street. People all across our country, Democrats and Republicans, know we're getting worked over by the market power of big banks. They don't like it. They're still angry and steaming that we had to bail them out when there was, given the damage that they did to our economy. And it's not too much for people to expect that their federal government would protect our economy and regular people from getting worked over by mega big banks.
You turned some heads recently, some ears perked up when you linked climate change to the Islamic State. Are you suggesting that preventing climate change can be key to stopping terrorism?
Yeah, the way the Defense Department talks about this is they call it a threat multiplier. And in fact, there was an article that was published by a letter to the editor that was published by a number of generals talking about the link. What I pointed out on a recent interview, in fact, here and I, no, it was in Cedar Rapids, I think, before Cedar Rapids, was that we need a new foreign policy of engagement and collaboration and a new national security strategy that that recognizes and anticipates rising threats before they rise to a level where it seems the only options we have are boots on the ground or not. And as an example of that, I pointed out that because of the erratic weather patterns brought about by climate change, and I do agree with 98% of scientists who say that that's driven by human activity, we have seen mega droughts in parts all over the world, the mega drought that California is going through right now. But there was also a mega drought in Syria that preceded the collapse of that nation state and that preceded the rise of ISIL. And that mega drought drove people off of the land, drove them into cities. The government did not respond very well to that humanitarian and that drought crisis. They responded instead when people were expressing their displeasure and that they had nothing to eat or drink. They responded with oppression and repression. That brought about ultimately the unrest that led to a civil war, that led to the chaos, that led to the vacuum, that led to the rise of ISIL. But don't believe me. I mean, people in the Defense Department would agree with that scenario as well. So that's why when you look at a new foreign policy of engagement and collaboration, it is not only against terror groups or non-state actors. It is also against the very real human threats posed by climate change, the threats posed to humanity by pandemic coming out of West Africa. And these are the places where we need to forge new alliance and be smarter as a people in anticipating these threats, dialing up our power of diplomacy, development in collaboration with like-minded people to mitigate these conditions before they lead to a situation that becomes a security threat.
While we're in the Middle East talking about it, the Iran nuclear deal, big talking point for Republican candidates has been this deal struck with Iran. Do you think it's been good? Do you think it was a good deal that the U.S. negotiated with six other big world powers?
Yeah, I think it holds a lot of promise. And I think that the deal will be examined and read and will soon be released so we can see the details of it. The key is that it has to be verifiable and enforceable. We don't negotiate. If Iran were our friend, we wouldn't have to negotiate. Maryland was one of those states, perhaps Iowa, I don't know. But many states and many nations put in place tough, tough sanctions to drive the Iranians to the negotiating table in order to hopefully prevent them from developing a nuclear weapon through multiple pathways. So the key now is to make sure that it is, in fact, enforceable, verifiable, tightly monitored, and that we're prepared to snap sanctions back into place in the event that the Iranians were to cheat on this. But I think it holds a lot of promise, and I think that this is how an effective foreign policy works, not merely using our military powers, but also our diplomatic. We have to also be about waging peace. And perhaps this deal is that path forward.
Bouncing back to some domestic issues, the Environmental Protection Agency is something that gets talked about a lot in this state. Many Iowa farmers and agribusiness companies are concerned about the cost and interference of the EPA. Should the EPA be in the business of taking things by a case-by-case basis? Should it be federal? Should it be one size fits all? The states have a go at it individually. That's an argument you hear regularly here in the state, is that Iowa knows Iowa, so it should be regulating environmentally.
Yeah, I think you're talking about this in the context of clean water?
Clean water, yes.
Clean water. Our federal government, in fact, is charged, and our Congress has passed laws to create an agency that actually protects the health of the air and the water of the United States. That's not to say we're not connected to things that happen in other countries as well. I think what we all should be concerned about is making sure that the water stays healthy and clean for our sakes, for our health, and for the health of our kids and grandkids. There are very few issues. Now, if you're familiar with Maryland's geography, there are very few issues involving water and land use that I haven't dealt with in some capacity as governor, because right through the middle of our state is the largest estuary in the United States, the Chesapeake Bay. So on the western shore, we have all of the issues that affect the health of our water from a lot of development. I mean, dense development, lots of population. And then on the eastern shore, we have all of the issues that come from the agriculture, which is the heart and soul of our eastern shore of Maryland. The good news is this. We have figured out things that work we have figured out things that work on the land that actually improve the health of the streams. Upgrading your water and wastewater treatment facilities, better design in terms of controlling stormwater runoff, halting the sort of septic development, which exponentially over time will actually affect your groundwater and your streams. And then the fourth piece was one that we were actually leading on decades and decades before I was ever elected governor, and that is best management practices in agriculture. Our farmers were ahead of the game in implementing things that mitigated the sort of runoff and the degradation from nutrients of the streams. We're doing a lot more of it now than we ever have. We went from doing about 100,000 acres in cover crops to doing 400,000 acres in cover crops. And Governor Vilsack, Secretary Vilsack, and USDA helped our farmers as we implemented these best management practices in ways that were cost-effective and that worked for farmers. And ultimately, I mean, we got to keep farmers profitable and make them more profitable, because that's important for our economy. That's important to feed us. That's also important for our environment and to protect our open spaces.
Moving on to education, you threw some punches at Republican Governor Terry Branstad at the Hall of Fame dinner in Cedar Rapids.
I didn't even remember that.
Education funding.
I'm sure they were well considered.
Some vetoes that he had over K-12 funding in the state of Iowa. What role does the federal government play in education standards?
This is something that federal government and the states do together. I mean, one of the greatest sources of assistance that all of the states, including Iowa, received in the aftermath of the recession after President Obama's election was the support for schools. And if we had not received that support from the federal government, you would have seen layoffs, class sizes doubling and tripling. Those were very, very important dollars that we received. But it's always a shared responsibility, state and federal government. I'd like to see our federal government find a way to do more, especially where pre-K is concerned, and also infusing that fourth year of high school with more robust career and technical education. Having said that, there's no way the federal government can save a state that's hell-bent on cutting taxes for wealthy corporations and then telling people that we have to cut funding for schools because we don't have any money. That's a matter of priority. So for my part as a governor, even during the recession, we invested more in our schools, not less. I still have the scars to prove it, too, because some of the things we had to do were not individually popular. We asked everybody to pay another penny on their sales tax. But for the first time ever, in the middle of a recession, we made our public schools the best public schools in America, and we held that distinction for 5 years in a row, according to Education Week magazine, treated our teachers as the partners and the professionals that they are in this mission. More of our kids take AP courses and pass them than any other state in the nation. There's some things for which the answer is not to do less. It's to do more, and education is one of those.
And speaking of children, Iowa is home to a lot of these dreamers, so-called dreamers, those children that have come here illegally. What do we do with them?
Well, dreamers or refugees or—
There's both.
Right. I believe that the enduring symbol of our nation is not the barbed wire fence or the chain link fence. I believe the enduring symbol of our nation is the Statue of Liberty. And one of the things that has allowed us to become the land of opportunity and to give our children a better future, in addition to some of those other things we touched on, educating our children every generation at higher and better levels, wage policies, investment policies in our infrastructure. There's also a stable and balanced and predictable rule of law that protects us not only from Wall Street excesses or concentrated monopoly power that works us over as consumers or farmers or workers, but also protects our borders and maintains a sensible immigration system. So I believe we need comprehensive immigration reform. I believe that one step on that path is to allow children who, in their own memory, know no other country but our country to be able to stay here, to go to school, and to become all they can be. So in our state, we actually passed a state version of the DREAM Act that said if your parents, wherever they are in the naturalization process, pay state taxes, you should be able to go to at in-state rates to a state school. And then we defended it at the ballot. We also, when the children were coming over the border escaping death from the drug gangs in Central America, I know that here in, I know that in our state, this is the way we chose to go. I know that other states talked about those refugee children that had risked death and starvation and worse across that desert, talked about them as if they were some invading swarm of jackrabbits, rascals that needed to be rounded up. We treated those kids with dignity and respect. I pulled together faith leaders throughout our state, and we ended up housing not in internment camps, but in individual foster care homes with the help of religious leaders, more children per capita than any other state in the nation, over 3,000 the last I checked. And you know what? They did not in any way harm or hurt our quality of life or our economy. We are a generous and compassionate people, and we are called upon not only by our faith in one another and our faith in our country, but we are called by the faiths of every religion to treat strangers with dignity and with respect, especially when they're fleeing for their lives.
One last question. 2 to 3 words. You've spent a lot of time here in Iowa. How do you describe Iowa in 2 to 3 words?
Iowa. 2 to 3 words. Iowa. 2 to 3 words. The people, the state, the place.
You name it.
Open, generous, forward-looking.
Governor O'Malley, thanks a lot.
Thank you.